Welcome to another episode of the We Have a Meeting podcast. So today I'm very, very excited for this conversation. As a big lover of psychology, I'm excited to deep dive into the human mind today. So our guests today are experts when it comes to the human mind, but more specifically, the inner chimp. So who or what is the chimp, I hear you ask? Well, today we're going to learn how to understand the chimp, how to disarm the chimp, and more importantly, how do we sell to the chimp? So today we're joined by the owners of Slingshot Edge. Please welcome to the podcast, it's John and Callum. Hello, gents. How are you?
Hello, Jack.
Very good.
Feeling good.
Good to see you both.
Thank you so much for joining us. Obviously, we're big advocates of the chimp and the things that you talk about on LinkedIn. So I guess I'll let you fight amongst who takes it first. We start our podcast in the same way every time. Who are you and what problem do you solve?
Do you want to fight, John?
No, you bash on if you like. You're the founder of the chimp, so I think it's only appropriate.
Okay, well, I'm Callum, this is John, as you just said. I look after this company called Slingshot Edge. What do they do? What problem do they solve? Well, the problem they solve is that CROs typically are sales leaders of, I don't know, organisations that are maybe selling something reasonably complex that involves multiple buyers, and typically the sales process maybe takes 6 months to a year, and they've got quite a big sales force. So that type of person, well, they're struggling in some way. They probably wouldn't admit they're struggling, but they're wanting to sell more, to grow faster. And the types of problems that they're having is that, well, a vast amount of their deals are ending in what they call no decision. So a buyer enters a process and exits the process 6 months later, doing nothing different than they were when they came in. So that's one problem. A lot of these companies, the buyers are trying to commoditize what the seller is offering. So whilst the CRO thinks and believes and knows they've got something fantastic and differentiated, they find it very hard to get across that differentiation, to look different to their buyers. And when that happens, well, they're just in a price war. What's the other problem? Well, this comes in different guises, but a current client that we're working with, you can imagine in these deals, to close that deal, you have to get lots of people to say yes. Any one of them saying no, then it's likely you're not going to win that deal. So maybe up to 10 or even more people all have to say yes. And the seller, they have to be able to navigate round about that buying committee. So a current customer we're working with, their sellers are struggling to navigate to the more senior people in that sort of buying committee. So that's maybe three big problems that people might come to us to help them fix.
I can tell it's going to be a good episode already. So I guess, John, you both worked in sales for a while and you were telling us the love story of how you guys met before it aired, but why the chimp? Why did the pair of you cling on to the chimp, and what was the love story involving the chimp there?
Well, again, Callum probably picked up the chimp first, but I've always had a deep interest in human behaviour, probably through necessity. I've never sold particularly pretty bits of software. It's always been the ugly child, and usually the most expensive child as well. So you're selling ugly, it's functionally strong but very expensive, not that pretty software. So I think how you sold or how you sell becomes way more important than what you sell. And we used to start, when I was younger, I'd pick up any book I could on behavioural science or just anything that could help me understand how humans think, how they make decisions, how they feel value. And then using that to try and win opportunities where you're probably more expensive and not particularly pretty. It was a few years later, I think, that Callum got into the chimp when he set up Slingshot, probably 8 years ago.
Yeah, where did the chimp come from? Well, talking about expensive children, maybe not, well, I wasn't going to say ugly, but I've got four children as well, Zach. So this particular child is, it's not ugly. It's probably quite expensive. But he was probably about, 12, 13 years old at the time, and he was going crazy quite a lot. He couldn't really manage his emotions. He was having lots of tantrums. I remember one time he was very naughty. So this probably, I'll probably get locked up for this, but as part of his punishment, he got put in our porch, kind of like a naughty step. And he was so raging mad, there's some glass on the other side of our porch, that he battered the door so hard that he smashed the glass. So we were trying to understand him. He wasn't in control of his emotions. So I looked around about for books and help to try and understand his emotions. In this book, The Chimp Paradox, came up, and I read it and tried to use some of the lessons in there to help him understand his own emotions. But the more I got into that sort of stuff, the more I realised that, well, there's a huge amount of emotions at play in sales, and a lot of the barriers the seller is up against is as a result of the kind of knee-jerk reaction of their buyer's chimp, either not trusting them or wanting to get rid of them or thinking they're pushy and manipulative. So it seemed like a good model to adopt inside this company.
So it's probably worth, Callum, if we stick with you, just stepping back, because I've just been conscious that people might be listening to this thinking, what are they talking about when they say the chimp? So it's probably good maybe to set the scene of, what are we referring to when we say the chimp? How would you best explain it?
Okay, well, the guy that invented or that wrote this book called Chimp Paradox is a guy called Professor Stephen Peters, a psychiatrist, scientist, and he's now a sports psychologist as well, and he's helped many of the British athletes manage their own emotions, and which is their inner chimp, and get lots of gold medals, which is fantastic. So essentially, this guy's model is there's a chimp and there's a human, and the chimp represents a human being's emotional mind. And, well, he chose the chimp because, well, there's a lot of similarities between the chimp's way of thinking and the way a human thinks as well. But also, if you think about a chimp, it's very, very strong. It kind of thinks in black and white. It's easily frightened. So many of these characteristics that you might associate with a chimp are also associated with a human's emotional mind. So that's the chimp. But there's also a more logical mind inside every human, of course, that comes from a place of rationale. Sense of humour lives in the chimp, by the way. John?
Yeah, there's probably two Bibles that we refer to. I think The Chimp Paradox is one. The other Bible is a book by Danny Kahneman, Thinking Fast and Slow. Don't know if you guys have read that.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah. I used to have a bit written on my board about priming. It seems to help people in their prospecting. So like, if you fill in the gap yourself, that there's a bit in it about soap or soup. Do you remember that bit?
That's right, yeah, you fill in the blanks.
So it's like if you're thinking of a shower, you'll think it's soap. If you're thinking of a restaurant, you'll think it's soup. But your brain does it automatically for you. And I was telling my guys about sometimes you're filling in the narrative yourself before you even get into the calls, which was a good way of illustrating that. But yeah, I love that book. Sorry, John, I interrupted you there. Keep going.
Yeah, no. Good. I mean, I think it holds the record for being the book that's been started the most number of times but never finished, because it gets quite heavy and quite deep quite fast. But if you look at Kahneman's stuff and you think about System 1, so he talks about fast thinking, automatic thinking, very skillful. It's automated. You build habits, you build skills, very reflexive. That maps nicely onto the chimp as well. And System 2, he talks about slow, conscious, effortful thinking, who you think you are. It's the conscious you, but really the chimp is driving all the decisions behind that. So System 1 and System 2 maps very nicely onto the chimp and human model. But I think the chimp-human model makes it very easy and concrete for sellers to understand. You've got these two very clear, distinct characters. But if you've read Fast and Slow, you'll start to map these things across quite nicely as well. And for me, that's the Bible when it comes to things like heuristics, cognitive biases, how we think, how we feel value. Thinking Fast and Slow is a good place to start for most people.
So who's in charge then? if we're talking about people sat right now and they're thinking, that's not me, there's no chimp in my head, when do you notice those moments where the human isn't in charge anymore and the chimp is, or do you even notice them at all?
You probably notice them. If you've ever driven down the motorway and someone's cut you up and you've started effing and blinding and maybe waving your hands about, that's certainly the chimp. And maybe 2 or 3 seconds later you go, that wasn't such a great idea. A little bit of regret sets in, and that's the human catching up. The human has to validate or ratify every conscious decision. So the chimp does make decisions without the human because it has to keep you alive sometimes, so it will act on its own behalf. But every conscious decision that the human gets involved, but the human is extremely lazy. It's almost like a very lazy CEO. So yes, it has to ratify the decisions, but most of the time, the chimp pulls the strings because the chimp is much more powerful, probably 4 or 5 times powerful, more powerful than the human. It thinks probably 4 or 5 times faster. So most of the time, the human just goes with the chimp. So if you come in from work late at night, you've done a hard shift, and you go, I should really fix that stuff tonight, but do you know what? It's been a long day, and I've got all weekend, right? We can do it at the weekend, and I've got plenty of time at the weekend to do this, right? So that's the chimp justifying itself and trying to find just some gratification. It doesn't want to, it's quite lazy, the chimp as well, so it will delay tasks, and it will logically justify delaying those tasks as well. So the chimps, there's a constant conversation, and you're not aware of it, right? It's subconscious, but there's a constant conversation between these two parts of your mind. And the logical human finds it very hard to overpower the chimp. So most of the time it rolls with the chimp's suggestions.
It's crazy. Yeah. It's so fascinating. And I think I remember after I just read The Chimp Paradox, I think there was an instance where I'd re-listened to a podcast and I found myself burning some bread and throwing a burnt toastie off the balcony, and I was like, that's my chimp. Why did I do that? But it's when you've got the reflection.
As soon as information comes into your brain, whether you're watching something, listening to something, reading something, or having this conversation, that information will pass through the chimp first. So the chimp essentially turns around to the human and knocks it out and says, look, I've got this. I'll deal with this and decide whether or not this is important. If it's important and I can't handle it, I'll bring you into the conversation. So that regret is the human catching up after the chimp's thrown the toast over the banister.
Okay. So Callum, it's making sense, and I'm sure people that have never heard this before are starting to understand the chimp, and we talk about disarming the chimp with humour and honesty and allowing them to say no and all that lovely stuff. But where does sales come into play then? Like, how do we use the chimp and the psychological tact to sell better?
Well, it's essentially the chimp. And we're kind of, just to sort of backtrack a little bit, it might have sounded like we're painting the chimp in a bad light as being this crazy emotional thing that's constantly doing silly things. You know, most of the time it does the right thing. It's there to protect you. So the chimp is your friend. But it does think very, very fast and does react very, very fast based on a model of the world that it's built up in the past. So how does that relate to sales? Well, essentially you need to get the chimp. I mean, you're never going to get a buyer to buy from you, even if they need your stuff. If they're not emotionally on side and logically on side. So when you are in conversation with your buyer, there's a invisible force, if you like, working against you to begin with. And if you are getting on with your buyer, understanding them, making them feel heard, then slowly your buyer will begin to trust you. But in the beginning, that trust is not there because this chimp's past experience of the world, of sellers, is that sellers are pushy, manipulative, sleazy liars. So it comes to the conversation with that bias, with that prejudice against you. So if you're not aware of that, then you might not be able to have a conversation, or your buyer might just say something to you say, yeah, I'll give you a shout back, or let's meet again in a week, and you might never hear from them again, and you might not understand why. But when you begin to understand this model that's in your buyer's head, and they're predisposed to reject you, then, well, first of all, you can understand seemingly crazy behaviour of your buyer. But secondly, you can begin to come up with strategies to avoid that rejection. And you guys are probably, because of what you do every day, you guys are probably pretty expert at that.
Mm. Well, I guess I'd love to bat it over to you guys, and John, it might be great to take it. So what are some of those strategies, and what are some of those actionable takeaways? If somebody's sat there on YouTube now and they've got their notepad and they're thinking, you know what, I'm going to leave with a killer one line or a killer question to make sure I'm disarming chimps left, right and centre, what could you give them?
It's hard to give one thing, but I think if you look at some of the data, right, one of the main concepts to get across that we encourage with sellers is, if you look at the data, leading with ROI and logical style messaging, if you look at that, there's a correlation with a decrease in win rates. And when you understand the chimp and human model, it makes kind of sense, right? The chimp, first, it's an associative machine. It recognises patterns. It thinks you're a pushy, manipulative, lying seller. That's just its stereotype bias default. It can't help that. It hears these ROI messages, these value messages, and it goes, I've heard this many times before from every other seller promising me the world. Don't believe it, don't trust it. And it doesn't think in those terms. ROI is business value. The chimp is much more concerned with itself than business value. So Gartner did a pretty interesting study about 7 or 8 years ago. They looked at what motivates or mobilizes a champion. How do you develop a champion? How do you motivate someone to advocate and drive change in an organization? And they looked at three different types of value. They looked at business value as one driver or lever. So business value is how you help the business win with your offering. So make more money for the company, increase profitability, reduce risk. Fantastic. They looked at something called professional value. So professional value is how you help your prospect, your champion, do their job better, easier, less stress, less hassle, more efficacy. But the third dimension they looked at was something called identity value. And they found that was the only dimension that had any correlation with someone's likelihood to drive change and mobilise change. And identity value is how you help them personally win. So if you're selling, I don't know, supply chain software to a supply chain manager, and you're just talking about the improvements in revenue, the improvements in customer profitability, all the fantastic benefits that the company could enjoy if they change and take action, you're missing out on that sense of identity value. What really resonates with that supply chain manager that you're trying to develop as a champion? You have to talk to the things that are going to help them improve their profile, improve their status, increase their recognition. Understand what they really care about. How are they measured, their KPIs, for example? Because when they're sitting down at the end of the year with their boss, they're going to get measured on their KPIs. Their reputation hangs off that. And the chimp is deeply precious about its reputation and its status. So understanding that, particularly in these larger enterprise deals where sellers are just going in and talking about business value at best, because often they don't. They often get hung up on professional value. Oh, we can help you do it faster, quicker, easier. Okay, if they're good, they'll talk about business value. We can help you reduce risk, increase profit, but everyone's talking about that anyway, right? If they're really good, they will align with that sense of identity value. They will show you what's in it for you, how you can become that hero in the organization, how you can improve your reputation. Because the problem is with these enterprise deals is, if I'm going to drive change and champion this particular project, 7 out of 10 or something like that, large IT projects don't deliver their benefits, the intended benefits. They fail to some degree. So I'm going to put my head above the parapet for the benefit of the company. If this backfires, that's not fantastic for me. My reputation's on the line. My job might be on the line as well. So if I don't see a big enough personal driver or personal what's in it for me in this, I'm not going to advocate change. I'm not going to drive change. You're never going to get a champion. So understanding the pains, that your champion may experience. You guys are fantastic at this, right? You, when you do your cold calling, you're kind of tapping into the talk track, the emotional talk track in your persona's head. You're trying to find some resonance, emotional resonance, with something they're probably feeling or experiencing. But you're going to have to tap into that, particularly in these enterprise deals, if you want to try and build champions. So that would be the big takeaway, is your prospect is an emotional thinker. You're not selling to a business, you're selling to people. You're influencing change. If you want to influence and drive change, you really have to speak to the identity value of that potential champion, how they personally win. So understanding their world, understanding what KPIs they may have, understanding what they care about, because identity value as well is also the things that you're passionate about, your beliefs, your ideology, your philosophy. So if you believe in creating a very nurturing environment for your team that nurtures your sellers, develops them, that, you know, if you can align with that as a seller, that's identity value. That speaks to the identity value of that CRO. So that's the big thing for me, is how you tap into that.
And to be clear on this word value, so the word value is used every day by sellers. It's all over LinkedIn. The chimp actually hates that word value, because you can't pick it up. It's not like this cup. You can't touch it, feel it, smell it, taste it, feel it.
That your whiskey?
That's my whiskey, yeah.
Must be, yeah.
You can't, it's a non-concrete entity. So to be clear on what we mean when we say value, it's the difference between two states, two emotional states. The difference between the emotion of pain and the difference between the emotion of desire. And as John says, there's three flavours of that. Identity, professional, and business. Pain, identity, professional, and business, desire. So the value is the difference between the two.
I think if you look at what you guys do as well, and you look at some of your scripts or, you know, your cold call frameworks, you probably touch on those three dimensions. Certainly you touch on identity value and probably professional value as well, because those are the things that are more personal to the chimp. Yeah, my job, it is stressful, it is a hassle, it takes too long, it takes forever. And by the way, I'm struggling to achieve these things that I actually care about, because I get measured on these things.
So is one of the negative realizations the more you delve into this world that everyone's a narcissist?
I think one of the chimp rules is it's not selfish, but it's very self-focused. It is. I mean, the hero in your life story is you, right? You are the center of your universe. So you are always looking at the world from your perspective. It's very hard not to do that and not to put yourself first. I think there's an argument against saying the chimp's selfish, because from a survival perspective, it doesn't help to be selfish. We survive in numbers, so collaboration is important. And if you are purely selfish and self-centred, you probably wouldn't have survived for too long back in the day. So I think it's not necessarily narcissistic, it's not necessarily selfish, but it's extremely self-focused. And it's going to put itself in the centre of its thoughts before it thinks about someone else. Which is probably why sellers, again, the stereotype bias is there, because sellers go in there and talk about themselves, right? Maybe not overtly, but they're talking about their product and their solution and their capabilities, and we do this and we do that and we can help you achieve these things. And the chimp is listening to that in your prospect's head going, you know, this is all about you. You're the hero in this particular storyline. And that's probably one of the hardest things for our sellers that we train to shift, is how they flip their language around and stop the kind of we and I and our, and start empowering prospects and, you know, aligning with that chimp sense of self. So you can do this, you can achieve this, you can avoid these pains and these hassles, you can achieve this better, brighter future.
Callum, anything to add?
Well, the chimp, another thing, the chimp, so there's two chimps at play here in any interaction. There's obviously the buyers or prospects chimp. So a lot of the stuff that we talk about is trying to understand that and strategies to avoid being rejected by that chimp on, and getting that chimp on side. But there's also your own chimp as a seller. So it's that chimp inside your own... Well, I'm touching my heart here as if the chimp's inside my heart, but it's inside my head. But the feeling it generates is inside your heart, because maybe if you've... I mean, we don't necessarily do cold calls very much, but if we were to suddenly start practicing doing cold calling, your chimp would be coming up with all sorts of stories about what's going to happen to you. You're going to get rejected. What if they call you out and this? What if they ask you that? And there'll just be constant stories inside your head that can paralyze you. So the chimp affects the seller as well. And from a goal-setting point of view, so the chimp cares not just about the individual's survival, but the chimp cares about the survival of the species. And in that, I mean, it keeps us constantly dissatisfied so that we're constantly striving for more. We can never quite reach our goals. In fact, there's a Greek god called Tantalus, who was the son of Zeus, and he was getting punished. I don't know what he'd done wrong. He'd been a naughty boy in some way, and he got punished, and he was put into this perpetual room, and above him was delicious, beautiful fruit on trees, and below him was amazing, delicious water, probably carbonated in some way. And any time he put his hand up to pick the delicious fruit, the branches moved out of his way. He couldn't get it. And every time he bent down to taste the amazing water, the water subsided and he couldn't get it. And that's where the word tantalizing comes from Tantalus, because these goals were always out of reach. And it's the same for human beings. We set these goals, I'm sure you did with your company, and by the time you've achieved one goal, you've almost forgotten it, and you're thinking about the next one. You're saying, oh, if we could only do that, then everything would be all right, I'd be happy. If I could only get that amount of money, then everything would be all right, I'd be happy. So us humans are never satisfied, and that's because a satisfied human race is not good for the survival of the race, because they just sit and stagnate. But if we're always dissatisfied, we're always going to strive for more.
So I suppose based on that, then, is the chimp chasing an image, i.e. I will be here in this house with this car with these things, or is it chasing a feeling? If I get to this point, I will feel like this and then I'll be happy. Is it the image or the feeling? Which one is it? Is it chasing?
Well, I guess it comes from a place of feelings. You're getting so deep, we should get Professor Steve Peters on the show. Because you're now yeah. going deeper than my understanding of the chimp. But the chimp comes from a place of feeling. John?
It's definitely driven by feeling, right? If you look at even Kahneman's work, what is value? Value is the contrast between two emotional states. It's two psychological states. So let's say you guys have been working all year, you're kind of stressed out, it's been a long old slog, you go off on vacation somewhere nice and sunny for a week. You want to go on vacation to hit that feeling, right? Maybe 2 or 3 days in, you're sipping your cocktails and having a fantastic old time. So you could say the value from that experience is the contrast between two emotional or psychological states. The problem with a chimp is it believes that by attaining certain things, like that new house or that new car or that new job, it's all of a sudden going to be satisfied with life. And what happens? You get that new car, you get that new job, you move house, and after maybe 6 or 7 months or however long, depending on how flitty you are, it becomes your status quo, right? It becomes your normal, it's your reference point, it's your baseline. So the chimp is now looking for more. So, and you know, if you're a millionaire, right, you've got this goal to become a millionaire. What do millionaires do once they become millionaires? They want to be multimillionaires. What do they do? Not everyone, but a lot of them, when they're multimillionaires, well, I want to be a fucking billionaire. So this chimp is always looking for more. And it's quite an interesting thing when you look at our species, because all we seem to be doing is innovating. We're constantly innovating. potentially innovating ourselves out of existence. We don't know, right? But we're continually innovating. We cannot stop. What's wrong with my iPhone? Nothing. Will I get a new iPhone next year? Probably.
So it sounds like, from what I'm hearing, and tell me if I'm wrong, but like entrepreneurs and businessmen will probably have a stronger chimp than others, maybe. Like, obviously, if we lined everyone up, I'm guessing not all chimps are equal. So why do some people have a stronger chimp and some people don't? Is it a nature-nurture thing, or are the questions getting too deep now and we want to take it back to basics?
I think all chimps are strong. It's just how it exerts itself, or how it manifests. So someone that sits on their couch, on their sofa all week doing bugger all, that's the chimp. That's a very strong chimp. It's just a very lazy chimp. Someone, as you say, Jack, that's entrepreneurial, driving their business, that's a strong chimp as well. But this chimp is insanely or innately more curious. No, is it innately? I don't know if it's innate. Going back to your point, I think there's a combination of nature and nurture.
Again, listening to Steve Peters, he will say a lot of what your chimp behaves today is often set in stone by some sort of trauma that's happened in your youth. And if you listen to some of these entrepreneurs, the guy Ballantyne, who used to be in Dragon's Den, what was his first name?
Duncan
Ballantyne. If you ask him, what drives you? He talks about when he was young, he was in extreme poverty, and he just, it was horrible. He made a sort of pact to himself that he didn't want that to happen to him when he was older. So he's been constantly driven to get away from that poverty. And even though he's a millionaire, as John says, he still wants to do more and get away from that.
That's probably true for a lot of guys. Elon Musk had a terrible childhood.
Yeah.
Steve Jobs. A lot of these guys, girls who've been driven, have had pretty hard childhoods. I think, going back to your question as well, I think we're all born very curious. I think naturally we're very curious about the world around us, but I think the first 2 or 3 years, formative years of your life, the nurture element can have a big impact as to why some people want to become scientists and that curiosity continues and develops and other people don't. So I think your formative early years can have a big impact on whether or not you develop that curiosity or not.
So you work with organisations and businesses to basically teach them how to use these tips and tricks and these laws that you talk about, and how to use it to their advantage when it comes to dealing with other people's chimps. And from our side, when we're selling, especially when we're cold calling, if we're cold calling on behalf of We Have a Meeting, it's like a mini job interview. It's like a, do you like this? Because this is effectively what you'd be getting if you buy into it. What kind of things do you do during the buying process? Because I'm guessing, because you're so big on the chimp stuff, you can kind of flex those muscles a little bit more and be like, this is what you're going to get. Are there any questions that you ask in your little black book, or styles or paths that you take prospects down just to say that was actually your chimp reacting and it's a bit of a magic show?
Good question. Well,
Yeah, it's a great question. I don't know if it's a magic show, but once you understand what that chimp's there for, and then from there, you unpack that to, buyers are wanting value. What does that mean? Oh, well, they want to get away from pain and move towards desire. And then you unpack that into three dimensions of pain and three desire and three dimensions of desire. Suddenly, that's a model for discovery. So essentially, in discovery, you are wanting to try and uncover these three dimensions of pain and three dimensions of desire. There's more you want to uncover, but that's a very good start. So if you're an enterprise seller, you've got an interested party in some way, eventually you're going to have to get a committee to all get on board. To begin with, you have to develop a champion, and the way you do that is by using this model to try and understand their motivations, because that value, difference between desire and pain, is their motivation. So use that for discovery. There's some other stuff on top of that. Chimps love stories. So, because they're born hugely curious, so there's a very specific storytelling model that, again, people that come to us use or we teach them. And that storytelling model layers on top of these of that value model as well. So,
The other thing, that I was going to say is the chimp is insanely curious. So if you can set up a knowledge gap very early on in the conversation, which you guys probably do as well, something that disrupts conventional wisdom or conventional thinking, the chimp will not let go until it closes that knowledge gap. So we often lead with what we would call disruptive truths, such as leading with ROI, you lose more deals, reminding your prospect of the pain and cost of inaction. If they're indecisive, you lose more deals. Conventional wisdom, right? It sounds like reasonable things to do, but you actually lose more deals when you do these things. So that naturally pulls people into a conversation. They're like, okay, you know, what's going on here? So you then start to take them into this chimp-human model. We often ask a question, actually, on our initial discovery calls. We put a little puzzle up. It's a little puzzle. I'll try and relate it now. So we say, look, imagine a bat and a ball cost $1.10. That's the combined cost of these two items, $1.10. The bat costs a dollar more than the ball. How much does the ball cost? Now, you don't have to answer, right? But most people say 10 cents. It's an intuitive trick. And we then use that to explain the chimp-human model. We say, look, the reason most people think it's 10 cents is because the chimp can't do logic, but it's very powerful. It's a very fast, intuitive thinker. To get it right, you have to employ the human. Most people don't do that. So it's almost like a proof point. And they go, okay, right, got it. So they're on board very quickly, right? Because they've proved to themselves that they're not the rational, logical thinkers they are.
I love it. And then on your website, you talk about the seven laws. Could you run us through some? I don't want you to give all of the paid good stuff away for free, but would you run us through and kind of give us a bit of a rundown on those?
Sure. So the seven laws, we're going to go through them all. There's three S's and four C's in the seven laws. I'm sure you can guess. We've already spoken about the first. The primary law begins with an S. So the primary reason the chimp is there. What would you guess, Zach and Jack? It's to do with keeping me alive. Okay, safe. That's a good S. It's not quite the right one, but it's close enough. So it's survival. So your chimp is there to keep you alive, and almost every other law is a subset of that. What are some other good laws that might be interesting?
Contrast.
Yeah. So sellers are always raving on about value. They say, "Oh, can you see the value in that? I'll give you something valuable." And whilst people might nod and say, oh, yeah, that's valuable, no one actually knows what they're talking about when they use the word value. No one really knows what it means. Everyone's got a different definition. So if you think back to the three dimensions of desire and three dimensions of pain, value being the difference between the two, the chimp has to see contrast for it to feel value. So the example that John just said there about going on vacation, the contrast between how stressed you were before you went on vacation and how relaxed you felt in the middle of the vacation, well, that is the feeling of value. Translate that into your buyer's world, and it's the feelings of frustration because they can't get their job done easily and maybe their reputation is at risk when they're in a struggling state compared to, oh, I can get my job done easily. And people are looking at me and saying, that is one brilliant, competent individual. So the contrast between these two things is the feeling of value. So you need contrast everywhere. But sellers mess it up by saying, yeah, oh, the benefits of this are, if you do this, these great things will happen. They just talk about the good stuff. So you have to contrast the two to get that feeling.
You guys are big Chris Voss fans, right? I think.
Yeah, You two sound like the Scottish Chris Vosses.
What do you like about Chris Voss's stuff? What sort of stuff works for you?
We like... I'll give you an example in real life because this tends to be easier. If my son comes out of school and he's had a really rubbish day and I go straight into trying to save the day mode, he turns off. He doesn't like it. Sometimes it makes him feel more stressed, or I make the situation worse. If he comes out of school and he says, I've had a really bad day, and I say, God, that sounds really frustrating. He's like, shoulders come down, and he's like, yeah, no, it was really, and he opens up a bit more. I say, sounds like that's happening a lot. And he's like, no, mate, it's not happening a lot. Maybe it's like just today that it's happened. And really, he's talking himself in and out of a situation that's helping him calm down a bit more, rather than me adding insult to injury and like, now your dad's coming in to like kick the door down as well. Transversely, if I'm talking to CEOs who are lonely people, typically don't have anyone to turn to with quite complex problems, and when we get them down to simplifying that language, if I'm able to relay that in that setting, that's their inner 6-year-old, inner chimp, suddenly calming down in the call, saying, yeah, you know, that's right, that's exactly how I feel. So that's what I like. I think the route to disarming someone and empathising and getting them to think deeply and allowing them to persuade themselves rather than be persuaded, the Chris Voss stuff seems to work really well for that. I don't know if that's how you feel about it as well.
Yeah. I think you've touched on two of the laws there, really. You've touched on self, which is trying to look at the world from the perspective of, you know, their perspective and what's going on in their head and empathising with that. And control as well. The chimp craves control. It literally is a feel-good drug to have choice and control. Dopamine flooding your brain when you feel you've got choice and stuff. And respecting that control and choice and the free will and autonomy of your prospect, I think, is really important. And most sellers are taught to do the opposite, right? I was taught to do the opposite. I was taught to try and take control and cut them down and remove choice. Removing choice can be a good thing at certain points, but I think the more you push and the more you try and control, the more they run away, right? The more they, yeah, maybe I agree to that meeting next week. Of course, yeah, no worries, 2:00 Tuesday, fine, ghosted, right? They just want you off the phone. And I think that's probably one of the big things, yeah, it's that actually when you start to just not give too much of a shit about whether or not this meeting progresses, or whether they are interested and engaged at the end, I think when you step back, it just becomes more enjoyable for both parties. There's no pressure. Mm. And you offer them control. I have this argument all the time on LinkedIn. I don't know if it's on LinkedIn, but I really don't like when sellers set next steps without bringing the prospect into the conversation and giving the prospect a voice to even just gauge if they want to continue the conversation, right? So I've heard people say, from a seller's perspective, here's what I think we should do next. I think this would be a great idea to set up this meeting for, you know, next week. And I'm like, I don't really give a fuck what you think as a seller, right? It doesn't matter what you think should happen next. Give them a chance, some breathing space to see what they want to do. I'm not saying they have to define next steps for you, because I think you do have to guide people, right? But give them a voice, give them an opportunity to at least find out if they're engaged in the conversation and they want to keep the conversation going.
I actually had a... Funny you bring that up. Someone was having a semi-argument with me the other day about this. I did a post basically saying that if you've done your job properly as a salesperson, the close should be what would you like to happen next, not here's my next steps and here's what I want to do. And this guy was basically trying to say that, no, buyers want you to take control at that point and tell them what you'd want to do. Like, maybe like some sort of kinky people in the bedroom. I think if someone told me, like, right, based on that, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to get a contract out to you. We're going to get you signed up. I'd be like, what? Hold on a second. Yeah. And that's when that chimp's going to come back to the front again and say, hold on a second, does this feel like a safe scenario? Is it going at the speed that I like? And that's where the reactance bias is going to come in and be like, actually, hold on a second. So I'm with you. I'm glad you brought that up. And I'm going to chop that up and send it to that bloke who told me that.
Well, it confuses me, right? I don't see the problem, because if someone's genuinely engaged based on the conversation you've had, and they're genuinely engaged, this is an interesting conversation, next steps is not a problem.
Hmm.
Next steps is only a problem if you're trying to force them into something they don't want to do. Because if they are genuinely engaged, they'll quite happily map out collaboratively what they think should be happening next. And I used to love that question as well, Zach. So what's your thoughts? What would you like to do? What's your thoughts on continuing the conversation? What's your thoughts on next steps? Because, listen, this isn't for everyone, right? Chimps and humans, not everyone's into that. And that's cool, right? And even just to get that initial reaction of, no, this is good. I want to bring in our CMO, or I would like to bring in some of our sales guys to the conversation, versus, yeah, well, let's maybe send me some info. So just giving them the opportunity to say something, so you can respect their autonomy, engage if they're interested or not, right?
That's the C again. That's the C for control. Just when you were talking about your kid, Zach, coming home from school, another C that you are respecting there is a C called cognitive ease. Quite a difficult word. But essentially, when people have to do difficult things, when people have to think, try and understand stuff, it's hard work for their head, and it can put them into what Kahneman would describe as cognitive strain. And you've only got so much of that before you turn off. So if you had said to your son, what happened at school today? How did it go? How are you feeling? Any one of these how and what questions takes effort for your son to reflect and then go, oh. And typically they just go, oh, I don't want to do that. I don't want to go there. So just say, fine. How are you? Fine. What happened today? Not much. Which is how so many teenagers react. But it's the same for buyers. Of course, questions are brilliant. But particularly what and how questions, that's going to push them into cognitive strain to some extent. Sometimes you want that. You want them to reflect deeply. However, sometimes you just want what's in the top of their head. And by not asking a question, but instead doing exactly what you did with your son, saying, oh, that sounds uncomfortable. It sounds like you've got some plans, or just having a guess at their emotional state and maybe what their situation is. Chris Voss talks about, what does he say? He says, oh, it's like putting a listening device on the side of the other person's head, suddenly listening to their thought processes. And they'll just give you what's at the top of their head, and they're much more likely to give you a true and honest reflection of real life if you do what you did, which was what Chris Voss calls a label.
So gents, I feel like we could talk to you all day. It's been brilliant and fascinating. I feel like I've learned a lot. I think we'll have to get you back on to delve even deeper and do a masterclass for us. If people want to work with you, they want to check out your content, they want to look at your lovely faces, well, where do they find you? How do they do that?
Well, probably LinkedIn is the first place to go. Our website, slingshotedge.com, is the next place to go. And between these two places, you'll be able to get in touch. Or there's some online self-paced courses on there that you can use as well to turn all that emotional intelligence into sales tactics and behaviours.
Beautiful. Thank you so much, guys. Thank you for joining us on the podcast today.
Thanks,
pleasure. Cheers, guys. Thanks. Cheers. Catch up.